A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about vitamins and minerals, the micronutrients. He's asking how and why these tiny compounds are so crucial to our health, what they actually do inside the body, and why we should care about getting them right.
A study just hit in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, NIH-funded, published March this year. 68% of U.S. adults have at least one subclinical micronutrient deficiency. Which is wrong, by the way. By the way, vitamin C in colds, the evidence is surprisingly thin. But we'll get there.
I knew you'd say that. Also, quick note, today's script is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro. What are these things doing inside us that makes the difference between just getting by and actually functioning?
The timing's right, because that 68% number changes how we should think about this. It's not a fringe problem. It's the majority of the population walking around with enzyme bottlenecks they don't know about.
By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro.
New voice in the mix.
Let's get into it. What's actually happening at the molecular level when one of these 28 goes missing?
You've got 13 vitamins, A, C, D, E, K, and the 8 B vitamins, plus roughly 15 minerals that we absolutely need, and then another half dozen trace elements where the science is still debating essential versus probably beneficial. Boron, for instance. We're still arguing about boron. Your body needs about 25 grams of magnesium total, 4 grams of iron, 2 to 4 grams of zinc. Tiny amounts relative to the kilograms of protein and fat you're carrying, but remove any one of them and entire pathways shut down.
The fundamental reason we can't just whip these up internally, because it seems like an evolutionary oversight, right? We can make cholesterol, we can make non-essential amino acids, but we can't cook up our own vitamin C.
And yet, if you zero out any one of them, things go catastrophically wrong. But in the primate lineage leading to humans, plus guinea pigs and fruit bats, that gene got knocked out by a mutation about 60 million years ago. Vitamin C and scurvy is the classic. But everyone knows scurvy. Let me give you a better one. Your thyroid gland uses iodine to make thyroid hormone, T3 and T4. No iodine, no thyroid hormone. In adults, that means goiter, which is the thyroid swelling up trying to trap every last iodine atom from the blood.
We're evolutionary freeloaders who got away with it until modern diets stopped cooperating.
The core principle that makes all of this matter is the cofactor relationship. Most micronutrients don't do anything on their own. They're prosthetic groups or coenzymes. They slot into enzymes and make those enzymes functional. According to the WHO, about 2 billion people worldwide have insufficient iodine intake. It's the single most preventable cause of intellectual disability on the planet, and it's solved by iodized salt that costs pennies.
Give me a concrete example. What actually breaks when, say, thiamine goes missing?
Thiamine, vitamin B1, gets converted in your body to thiamine, pyrophosphate, TPP. TPP is the coenzyme for pyruvate dehydrogenase. That's the enzyme complex that converts pyruvate into acetyl-CoA, which feeds into the Krebs cycle. If you don't have TPP, pyruvate can't enter mitochondrial metabolism. It backs up, gets converted to lactate instead, and you develop lactic acidosis. Meanwhile, your cells are starving for ATP. And here's where most people get confused. They think of vitamins as fuel, like, I take vitamin B12 for energy. B12 doesn't give you energy. Calories give you energy.
That's speed. 2 to 3 weeks, versus something like B12 deficiency taking months or years. What explains that gap?
Taking B12 fixes the anemia, which restores your energy, but the B12 itself isn't the energy source. It's the key that unlocks the door. The door was stuck. B12, on the other hand, we store 2 to 5 milligrams in the liver, and we recycle it through enterohepatic circulation. It can take 3 to 5 years to deplete B12 stores completely. Nothing for most people. If you're not deficient, those B vitamins just pass through and you excrete them as expensive urine. The energy lift from a Red Bull is the caffeine and sugar. The B vitamins on the label are marketing that exploits the word energy on supplement facts panels.
Severity of deficiency isn't just about how critical the nutrient is. It's about whether evolution expected you to find it every day or once a year.
Once the enzyme has its cofactor, adding more cofactor does nothing. It's like putting 10 keys in one lock. These are people whose enzyme systems are operating at, say, 70 or 80% capacity. You won't notice that day to day. Broadly, you can group them by function. First, you've got the ones involved in energy metabolism. That's most of the B vitamins. Thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, pantothenic acid, biotin, B6, B12. They're all cofactors in the Krebs cycle and related pathways. Without them, you can't turn food into usable energy at the cellular level. Your immune surveillance is weakened because superoxide dismutase needs copper and zinc and manganese in precise ratios.
That's the part that feels under discussed. We treat deficiency like it's binary. You either have it or you don't. But it's a gradient, and the middle of that gradient is where most people live.
Free radicals are a normal byproduct of metabolism, but they also come from pollution, smoking, UV radiation. Your body makes some antioxidants itself, but it needs these dietary ones as backup. The answer is that micronutrients are the rate-limiting factors in thousands of biochemical reactions every second. Yes, and vitamin D deserves its own segment because it's arguably the most interesting micronutrient. It's not really a vitamin, it's a steroid hormone precursor that your body synthesizes when sunlight hits your skin.
Let's zoom in on that assembly line for a minute, because I think this is where the aha lives. Walk me through what happens in the electron transport chain with a mineral deficiency.
Office of Dietary Supplements has a massive fact sheet on this, and the list of things vitamin D influences just keeps growing. And yet, globally, about 1 billion people are vitamin D insufficient or deficient. Electrons flow through to complex 3, then complex IV, and finally to oxygen to make water. Along the way, protons get pumped across the membrane, creating a gradient that drives ATP synthase. Now here's where minerals become indispensable. We have indoors. We have sunscreen. We have higher latitudes where UVB radiation is too weak for half the year. We have darker skin pigmentation, which is protective against sun damage but reduces vitamin D synthesis. We have aging, which reduces the skin's ability to produce vitamin D. It's a perfect storm. And deficiency doesn't look dramatic at first, it's subtle. Bone pain, muscle weakness, increased infection risk.
A single mineral deficiency can bottleneck the entire energy production system of the cell.
It's not just one cell, it's every mitochondrion in every high-energy tissue, brain, heart, muscle. Chronic low-grade iron deficiency without anemia affects something like 10-15% of menstruating women in developed countries. It has, and the mechanism is genuinely fascinating. Vitamin D modulates both the innate and adaptive immune systems. It helps activate T cells and macrophages, your cellular defense forces.
The zinc story is even broader, right? You mentioned over 300 enzymes.
Multiple meta-analyses have shown that vitamin D supplementation reduces the risk of acute respiratory tract infections, especially in people who are deficient to start with. The effect isn't huge, it's not a miracle drug, but it's real and it's biologically plausible. In children, this manifests as growth failure because growth hormone receptor genes can't be transcribed properly without zinc finger proteins binding to DNA.
The mechanism there is literally, zinc deficiency means certain genes don't get read. The DNA is fine, the sequence is fine, but the transcription machinery can't physically access it.
That leads to kidney stones, calcification of soft tissues, cardiac arrhythmias. It's rare, but it happens. Usually from people taking megadoses. Remove the zinc, the structure collapses, the protein can't bind DNA, and the gene doesn't get transcribed. It's a physical lock and key relationship that depends entirely on having that one metal ion in place.
This is where the modern diet story gets interesting, because it's not just about whether you eat zinc-containing foods, it's whether you absorb the zinc.
The fat-soluble vitamins are A, D, E, and K. These are stored in your liver and fatty tissues. You can absolutely overdose on them, especially A and D. So you can eat a bowl of whole grain cereal with zinc on the nutrition label and absorb maybe 15 to 30% of it. The rest is bound to phytates. Polar explorers eating sled dog liver. Dog liver, and especially polar bear liver, contains astronomically high levels of vitamin A, millions of international units. Eating it causes hypervitaminosis, A, which can be fatal. Symptoms include intracranial pressure, blurred vision, bone pain, peeling skin. There are well-documented accounts from Arctic expeditions where men died from this. It's a reminder that natural doesn't mean safe in any quantity.
That's the fat-soluble warning label. What about minerals? You mentioned iron, calcium, zinc, selenium. Where do those fit? And the 68% number suggests we're not handling it well.
And they're often harder to absorb than vitamins because they compete with each other for transport proteins. Zinc and copper, for example, they use the same absorption pathway in the gut. If you megadose zinc, you can actually induce copper deficiency. This is a real clinical thing. People taking high-dose zinc for immune support or acne, and then developing anemia and neurological problems because they've depleted their copper. The body is a balancing act, not a more-is-better machine. That subclinical insufficiency quietly raising your risk of everything.
Magnesium is one of the ones that's getting harder to get from food, right? Soil depletion, water filtration.
Modern agriculture has reduced magnesium content in vegetables and grains by an estimated 20-30% compared to mid-20th century levels, due to soil depletion and high-yield varieties that dilute mineral content. Hereditary hemochromatosis is a genetic condition where people absorb too much iron, and it slowly destroys their liver, heart, and pancreas. It's one of the most common genetic disorders in people of Northern European descent, and it's underdiagnosed because the early symptoms are just fatigue and joint pain.
Iron is another case where the dose makes the poison. But first, I think we should acknowledge that this isn't just academic. This is the operating manual for the machine you're living in, and most of us never read it.
Selenium is essential at about 55 micrograms per day, but toxic at 400 micrograms. That's less than a factor of 10. Zinc has a bit more room. Vitamin C has a huge margin because it's water-soluble. But you don't thrive, and over time, the compensation breaks down.
That's the biochemistry. But here's where it gets personal. Because your specific diet, medications, and even where you live determine which micronutrients you're actually getting. And that's where we're headed next.
They're tired, they're irritable, they're not concentrating in school, maybe they're eating ice. Pica, the craving for non-food items, is a real symptom of iron deficiency. A kid with mild zinc deficiency might have poor appetite, frequent infections, slow wound healing. Nothing that screams micronutrient deficiency. It screams kid who's a little off. You have to think of it and test. Standard panels miss a lot of subclinical deficiencies because serum levels are often maintained at the expense of tissue stores. Your body will pull calcium from bone, magnesium from cells to keep serum levels in range. And the other thing I saw, especially in Jerusalem where I practiced, was the intersection of poverty and deficiency. A family that could only afford white bread and sugary tea. The kids were getting calories, but zero micronutrient density.
Which means the standard blood work your doctor runs at an annual physical is probably not catching this.
Almost certainly not. Serum magnesium, for instance, represents less than 1% of total body magnesium. The rest is in bone and soft tissue. You can have normal serum magnesium and be severely depleted intracellularly. I have data. Food is better than supplements in almost every case for several reasons. First, food contains the micronutrient in its natural matrix, bound to proteins, embedded in fiber, accompanied by other compounds that aid absorption.
We're flying blind, most of us. Which makes Daniel's question, how and why do these things matter? More urgent than it might seem on first glance. And that's exactly where Hermann's molecular classification comes in.
A pill is just the isolated compound, often in a form the body doesn't absorb efficiently. We're still discovering how micronutrients interact. Vitamin D helps you absorb calcium. Vitamin C helps you absorb non-heme iron from plants. Vitamin K works with vitamin D to regulate calcium deposition in bones versus arteries. Fat-soluble vitamins need dietary fat to be absorbed. When you eat real food, you get these interactions for free. When you take isolated supplements, you're gambling that you know all the interactions, and we don't. There's no carbon skeleton, no stereochemistry to worry about. Your body either has the element or it doesn't.
That difference in structure dictates how they function inside us. A vitamin can be chemically transformed into a coenzyme, while a mineral slots into a protein as a charged ion.
There are exceptions, vitamin D in winter, folic acid in pregnancy, B12 for vegans and older adults, but the large randomized controlled trials of multivitamins show no reduction in cardiovascular disease, no reduction in cancer, no reduction in all-cause mortality. The Physicians' Health Study, one of the largest and longest trials, followed 14,000 male physicians for over a decade. The multivitamin group and the placebo group had the same mortality rates. Same heart attacks. Without it, the phosphate bonds are too unstable for enzymes to work with.
The vitamin becomes part of a molecular machine, and the mineral creates the electrostatic environment that makes the machine work. Different roles, same bottom line. Nothing happens without them.
And the people who are deficient, the ones who actually need supplementation, are often excluded from these trials or underrepresented. So you get a null result. A prosthetic group is a non-protein molecule that's permanently bound to an enzyme. Heme in hemoglobin is a prosthetic group. The global dietary supplements market was estimated at around $160 billion and growing. It's massive. And it's built on a premise that we're all walking around with gaping nutritional holes that can only be plugged by pills. The reality is, if you eat a varied diet with vegetables and fruits and some animal products or fortified plant alternatives, you're probably fine. Not definitely fine, get tested if you have symptoms, but probably fine.
Let's talk about some specific micronutrients that don't get enough attention. Everyone knows about vitamin C and vitamin D and iron. What are the underrated ones?
Magnesium is my number one underrated mineral. It's a cofactor for over 300 enzymatic reactions. Energy production, DNA synthesis, muscle contraction, nerve transmission, blood pressure regulation. And yet, depending on the survey, somewhere between 30 and 50% of Americans don't meet the estimated average requirement. Deficiency is linked to hypertension, type 2 diabetes, migraines, osteoporosis. It's in leafy greens, nuts, seeds, whole grains, foods that a lot of people simply don't eat enough of.
The symptoms of low magnesium.
Early on, it's subtle. Fatigue, muscle cramps, irritability. As it worsens, you get arrhythmias, seizures, severe muscle spasms. It's also notoriously hard to measure because most magnesium is inside your cells and bones, not floating in your blood. A serum magnesium test can look normal while you're functionally depleted. Pyruvate can't enter the Krebs cycle, so it accumulates as lactate. The nervous system, which is almost entirely dependent on glucose oxidation, loses its energy supply. Heart muscle weakens.
Compare that to vitamin B12 deficiency, which can take years to manifest.
It's like the traffic cop for calcium. Without enough K2, calcium can deposit in your arterial walls instead of your skeleton, contributing to both osteoporosis and atherosclerosis simultaneously. The same deficiency causing two opposite-looking diseases.
That's a wild mechanism. The calcium is there, but it's going to the wrong place.
And K2 isn't even on most people's radar. It's not in standard multivitamins at meaningful doses. The best sources are natto, which is fermented soybeans, popular in Japan, not so much in the West, and aged cheeses, egg yolks, liver. Not exactly what most Americans are eating for breakfast. So the broken gene drifted to fixation. Once it's broken across the whole lineage, you'd need a very specific set of mutations to rebuild a functional enzyme from a pseudogene, and there's no path for natural selection to favor partial restoration.
That's the broader pattern. Humans have lost the ability to synthesize about half the amino acids, most vitamins, and several other essential compounds. Each loss happened in an ancestral environment where diet provided plenty. We're evolutionary cheapskates. If the environment provides it, we stop making it. Saves metabolic energy. The problem is when the environment changes, when we move indoors, process our food, deplete our soils, the evolutionary bargain breaks down. You mentioned B12 earlier for vegans. That's a specific at-risk group.
B12 is almost exclusively found in animal products, meat, fish, eggs, dairy. Plants don't make it. Some fermented plant foods have trace amounts, but not enough to rely on, so vegans need to supplement or eat fortified foods.
Before we get to the food system, I want to make sure we've nailed the cofactor concept, because it's the intellectual backbone of this whole discussion. Every micronutrient we're going to talk about for the rest of this episode, the deficiencies, the supplementation debates, the food sources, all of it comes back to this. A vitamin or mineral is not a fuel. It's not a building block in the way protein is. It's a key that fits a lock, and without it, the lock stays closed.
There are roughly 2,000 known human enzymes that require at least one micronutrient cofactor. 2,000 locks, 28 keys. The math alone tells you why a single deficiency can have such wide-ranging effects. It's one of the strongest arguments for targeted supplementation in specific populations. Not everyone needs a multivitamin. But vegans need B12.
Which makes the subclinical problem more insidious than the acute deficiency diseases. Scurvy is dramatic. Your gums bleed, your teeth fall out, you die. But a 30% reduction in zinc-dependent DNA repair? Until the cancer diagnosis 20 years later.
That's why the JAMA Magnesium study hit me the way it did. 34% higher all-cause mortality. That's not a disease of magnesium deficiency. Zinc is involved in immune function, wound healing, DNA synthesis, protein synthesis, cell division. It's essential for growth and development. It's also crucial for your sense of taste and smell. Zinc deficiency literally makes food taste bland. There are over 100 enzymes that depend on zinc. It's in oysters, red meat, poultry, beans, nuts. Deficiency in the developing world is a major contributor to diarrhea and pneumonia in children.
The biochemistry we're describing isn't just textbook detail. It's the causal chain between what's on your plate and how long you live.
Between what's on your plate and how well you think, how well you fight infections, how well you recover from injury. Every physiological function you care about traces back to enzymes, and enzymes trace back to cofactors. That's the through line.
We've established the molecular framework. Let's move to the real-world part of this. If the biochemistry is clear and the deficiency data is alarming, the obvious next question is, what's actually happening in the food supply and in people's bodies that's creating this gap?
This is where the picture gets uncomfortable. We're not talking about beriberi or scurvy. We're talking about subclinical deficiencies, levels low enough to impair function, but not low enough to trigger the textbook disease. The NIHH. This is a huge practical problem. For some micronutrients, blood tests are great. Serum ferritin for iron stores. Red blood cell folate. For others, blood levels are tightly regulated and don't reflect tissue status.
Subclinical means you won't know. You won't have bleeding gums or heart failure. You'll have brain fog, more frequent colds, slower recovery from exercise, maybe some anxiety or poor sleep. Vague enough that nobody connects it to nutrition.
Calcium is even more tightly regulated. Your parathyroid hormone will strip calcium from your skeleton to maintain blood levels within a narrow range. You can have osteoporosis with perfectly normal blood calcium. Chronic magnesium insufficiency impairs DNA repair, promotes low-grade inflammation, accelerates vascular calcification. None of it screams deficiency disease. It just shortens health span.
Let's get into the mechanisms behind this hidden epidemic. You mentioned earlier that bioavailability is a bigger problem than most people realize.
If they have symptoms, fatigue, frequent infections, poor wound healing, muscle cramps, cognitive issues, you test what you can and you also take a dietary history. What are they actually eating? The dietary history often reveals the problem faster than the lab work. Iron is similarly affected. Non-heme iron from plants is already less absorbable than heme iron from meat, and phytates knock it down further. This is why vegetarian and vegan diets require careful planning. Then you pay special attention to B12, iron, zinc, calcium, and iodine. Plant-based diets can be perfectly adequate in all of these, but they require more planning.
The antagonisms go beyond phytates. You mentioned the iron-copper-zinc triad.
Zinc from plants is bound by phytates in whole grains and legumes. Soaking, sprouting, and fermenting reduce phytates and improve absorption. These are traditional food preparation methods that modern industrial diets often skip. The zinc-copper antagonism is the best documented. 50 milligrams of zinc daily for 10 weeks reduces serum copper by 30%, per a 2023 study in the Journal of Trace Elements in Medicine and Biology. Their biotechnology. Humans figured out thousands of years ago, without knowing what phytates or zinc were, that certain preparation methods made food more nourishing. Sourdough fermentation reduces phytates in bread.
Because copper is part of ceruloplasmin, which oxidizes iron so it can bind transferrin.
When corn was exported to Europe without this processing technique, pellagra, niacin deficiency, became epidemic. The traditional knowledge was lost in translation. The same dynamic plays out between vitamin D and calcium. They compete for transport proteins, which is why high-dose vitamin D can cause hypercalcemia if calcium intake is also high. It killed thousands in the American South in the early 20th century before they figured out it was a dietary deficiency. People thought it was infectious.
The modern world creates gaps that whole foods alone often can't fill. Not because whole foods are inadequate in principle, but because the food itself has changed.
Soil depletion is real and measurable. USDA data comparing crop mineral content from the 1950s to the early 2000s shows declines in magnesium, calcium, iron, and zinc across most staple crops. We're still learning. The story of folate and neural tube defects wasn't fully established until the 1990s. The link between vitamin D and immune function is still being mapped. The role of vitamin K2 in arterial calcification is relatively new. We've only known about micronutrients for about a century. Vitamins were discovered in the early 1900s.
Then there's vitamin D, which isn't a vitamin at all. It's a hormone we synthesize from cholesterol when UVB hits our skin. But we've moved indoors.
Office workers, night shift workers, anyone living above the 37th parallel in winter. They're not making meaningful vitamin D from sunlight for months at a time. And when they do go outside, they're wearing sunscreen, which blocks UVB. A few things. The microbiome connection is huge. Your gut bacteria actually produce certain vitamins, vitamin K, some B vitamins. The composition of your microbiome affects your micronutrient status in ways we're just starting to understand.
Iodine is another one that's quietly slipped. People used to get it from dairy because iodine-based sanitizers were used in milk processing. That practice has declined. Meanwhile, people are switching to plant-based milks and avoiding iodized salt because of hypertension concerns. The iodine intake picture has shifted dramatically in a generation.
The thyroid runs on iodine. Every molecule of T4, thyroxine, contains 4 iodine atoms. T3 contains 3. Single nucleotide polymorphisms that affect how efficiently you convert one form of a vitamin into its active form. The MTHFR gene variant affects folate metabolism.
Which brings us to the supplementation paradox. Because the logical response to all this is to just take a bunch of pills. But that's where things get dangerous.
Two people can eat the same diet and have different micronutrient status because their genetics are different. We're heading toward personalized nutrition, but we're not there yet. Fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, accumulate in adipose tissue and the liver. They don't have a rapid excretion pathway. Megadose vitamin A, and you can cause liver damage, bone pain, and intracranial pressure increases. For now, the boring advice is still the best advice. Eat some fruit, get some sun. Eat fermented foods. If you're in a high-risk group, get tested and supplement appropriately. Don't megadose, don't chase trends.
The minerals have their own toxicity profiles. Selenium has a terrifyingly narrow therapeutic window.
Selenium is essential. It's incorporated as selenocysteine into 25 human proteins, including glutathione peroxidases and thioredoxin reductases. The recommended daily intake is 55 micrograms. The pill that fixes everything is the one thing the supplement industry can't sell you. It's called a grocery store. Exceed it and you get selenosis, hair loss, nail brittleness, garlic breath odor from dimethyl selenide being exhaled, and eventually neurological damage. Brazil nuts can contain up to 90 micrograms of selenium per nut. I'll give you the nuanced answer. For most healthy adults eating a decent diet, no. The evidence doesn't support it. There are edge cases. People with malabsorption conditions, Crohn's, celiac, gastric bypass. People on very restrictive diets.
More is better. Fails catastrophically for selenium, for copper, for iron. Hemochromatosis is iron overload, and it destroys the liver and pancreas. And even for calcium, where excess supplementation increases cardiovascular risk without improving bone density beyond a certain threshold.
In those cases, a multivitamin might be a reasonable insurance policy. But it should be a decision made with a doctor, not because the bottle has a picture of a smiling leaf on it. The other 7 have lower biological activity, and the liver preferentially retains the natural form. The bioavailability difference is roughly 50%. It matters enormously, and this is something most consumers don't realize. The supplement industry is lightly regulated. The FDA doesn't pre-approve supplements for safety or efficacy.
The riboflavin urine trick. People see bright yellow after taking a B-complex and think, great, it's working. That's just riboflavin being excreted. It tells you exactly nothing about your B vitamin status. It's the supplement equivalent of checking whether your gas tank is full by looking at the puddle under the car.
These distinctions affect whether the supplement actually does anything.
You're paying for expensive urine if you buy the cheap forms. And the obvious fix, supplementation, is a minefield of interactions, toxicities, and bioavailability traps. Let's circle back to something you said earlier about food synergy, the idea that micronutrients in whole foods work differently than isolated supplements. Is there a specific example that really illustrates this?
The best example is probably the antioxidant story. In the 1990s, observational studies showed that people who ate lots of fruits and vegetables had lower rates of cancer and heart disease. The hypothesis was that antioxidants, beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E, were the protective factor, so they ran randomized controlled trials giving people high-dose antioxidant supplements. The CARA trial gave beta-carotene and vitamin A to smokers and asbestos workers, and the trial was stopped early because the supplement group had higher rates of lung cancer. The supplements were harmful.
That's a spectacular failure of the reductionist approach. Liver, oysters, sardines, egg yolks, sunflower seeds. These are nutrient-dense in ways that a fortified breakfast cereal will never match, because the food matrix itself enhances absorption. The zinc in oysters comes packaged with amino acids that improve uptake. The iron in liver is heme iron, which doesn't care about your phytate intake.
Liver is basically nature's multivitamin. And that's humbling. We can sequence genomes and edit genes and build AI models, and the best nutritional advice we can give is still, eat plants, don't eat too much, move your body. It's not flashy, but it's true. One serving a week covers an enormous amount of ground. Oysters are similar for zinc. 6 oysters give you about 30 milligrams of zinc in the most bioavailable form we know of.
The third piece people miss, drug nutrient depletions. Proton pump inhibitors. Omeprazole. Esomeprazole. They block stomach acid, which is required to release B12 from food proteins and to absorb magnesium. People stay on these for years, and nobody checks their micronutrient status.
And iodine intake can be inconsistent because not all salt is iodized, and not everyone uses iodized salt. These are solvable problems with public health interventions, but they require awareness and political will. Statins reduce CoQ10 synthesis by blocking the same mevalonate pathway that produces cholesterol. CoQ10 is essential for mitochondrial electron transport. It shuttles electrons from complex 1 and 2 to complex 3. That's public health in a sentence. We know how to prevent iodine deficiency, iodize the salt. We know how to prevent neural tube defects, fortify flour with folic acid. We know how to prevent rickets, vitamin D supplementation for infants.
Most doctors never mention this. The prescription comes with no warning, no monitoring protocol, no recommendation to supplement. You find out 5 years later when you're exhausted and your B12 is in the basement.
And the supplement industry doesn't help when it convinces well-nourished people to buy expensive pills instead of directing resources to the populations that actually need intervention. If you're on a statin, consider CoQ10 supplementation at 100 to 200 milligrams daily, particularly the ubiquinol form, which is better absorbed. These are not obscure interventions. The evidence is solid, the risks are low, and the upside is substantial.
We've covered the testing, the food-first approach, and those drug depletions. But here's the question that keeps me up, or would, if I weren't a sloth. We've been talking about population-level recommendations. RDA is set for the average person, but we're not average. Your genetics, your gut microbiome, your enzyme variants, they all change what you actually need.
This is where precision nutrition is heading, and it's genuinely exciting. We've known for years that genetic polymorphisms affect micronutrient metabolism. MTHFR, methylenetrahydrofolate reductase, is the famous one. About 25% of people of European ancestry carry a variant that reduces the enzyme's activity by roughly 40%. These people need more riboflavin to stabilize the enzyme and may need methylfolate instead of folic acid because their conversion pathway is sluggish.
VDR, the vitamin D receptor gene, has polymorphisms that affect how efficiently you use the vitamin D you have. Someone with a low affinity VDR variant might need higher serum levels to get the same biological effect.
FU2 is another one that doesn't get enough attention. It's a fucosyl transferase gene that determines whether you secrete blood group antigens into your bodily fluids. About 20% of people are non-secretors. They have a FU2 variant that changes their gut microbiome composition and reduces their B12 absorption efficiency. They also have lower vitamin E levels. It's a single gene, but it ripples through multiple micronutrient pathways.
The question becomes, will we eventually have personalized micronutrient dosing based on your full genetic and metabolome profile? Not take 400 micrograms of folate, but given your MTHFR status, your gut microbiome composition, your current metabolomic signature, and your medication list, here's your optimal intake for the next 6 months.
The NIH just launched exactly the trial to start answering that. It's called Nutrition for Precision Health, and it aims to enroll 10,000 participants. They're doing deep phenotyping, genomics, metabolomics, proteomics, microbiome sequencing, and then testing how individuals respond to different dietary patterns. The goal is to develop algorithms that predict individual micronutrient requirements rather than relying on population averages. They're expecting initial results in 2028 to 2030. That's not far off. The metabolomic profiling technology has gotten dramatically cheaper. What used to cost thousands of dollars per sample is now in the hundreds and dropping. Within a decade, a comprehensive micronutrient and metabolomic panel might be a routine annual test, like a lipid panel is today.
The challenge is that even when the science is ready, clinical practice lags. We still have doctors who don't test B12 in patients on metformin. Getting them to order a polygenic risk score and a metabolomic panel for micronutrient dosing is going to take a generation.
But the economics might push it faster than we expect. Subclinical micronutrient deficiencies contribute to immune dysfunction, cognitive decline, metabolic disease. The downstream costs are enormous. The JAMA study we mentioned, low magnesium linked to 34% higher all-cause mortality. That's not a trivial association. If precision nutrition can prevent even a fraction of that, the healthcare savings justify the testing cost many times over.
That's the thread that runs through this entire conversation. These aren't trivial gaps. We're talking about the molecules that make your enzymes work, that let your mitochondria produce energy, that allow your DNA to be transcribed and repaired. Running low on them for decades has consequences. The good news is that the tools to identify and fix these deficiencies exist right now. Not in 2030, but today. It just takes paying attention.
Asking the right questions, which is exactly what Daniel's prompt was about in the first place.
Eat nutrient-dense whole foods first, watch your medications, and keep an eye on where the science is going, because personalized micronutrition is coming faster than most people realize. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, the vibrant crimson dye known as Mali Red was widely believed across European textile circles to be extracted from a rare beetle found only in the Timbuktu region. It was actually derived from the roots of the West African sorghum variety called Kaffir corn, no beetle involved.
A dye mystery from Timbuktu.
I'm choosing to believe the beetle version was more interesting. This has been...
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.